Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're kicking off our end-of-year fundraising drive with a special discount offer from our partner, Heritage Foods USA, an online farm-to-table butcher shop specializing in heritage-breed, antibiotic-free meats. Donate to Heritage Radio Network before Sunday, December 4th at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and we'll send you an exclusive discount code for 10% off all Heritage Foods products. Help ensure another year of great food radio, get 10% off delicious and sustainably produced meat, and support small family farms all in one shot. How's that for a holiday miracle? Head to heritageradionetwork.org/donate by Sunday, December 4th to make your contribution.
This episode is brought to you by Juul, the immersion circulator for sous vide by Chef Steps. Order now at chefsteps.com/JOULE.
This is Mike Edison, host of Art Senses of Seizures. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, please visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45, 1 o'clock, a little late as normal, you know how we do. Joined as usual in the studio with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
We got Dave in the booth.
What up?
And today, special guest from Del Posto, the only Italian restaurant rated 4 stars by the New York Times, Chef Mark Ladner, to talk about his new book, the Del Posto Cookbook, along with the co-author, Michael. Michael, what's your last name?
Wilson.
Wilson. No relation to, like, the musical Wilsons,
huh? No, unfortunately.
So you don't have that kind of familial mess up to, like, because that would be a good story if you had, like, you know, weird Wilson stories.
I'm sure there's tons of weird Wilson stories because there's a lot of us, but yeah. I don't have any good ones.
Not related to the tennis ball people.
Nope.
any weird Wilsons in your back?
No, probably, but I don't know any of the stories. Mm-hmm. It's sort of boring, sorry.
All right. You know what I found out my last name means yesterday, strangely? Eagle power. Like Arnold is like some German version of eagle power. Anyway, call in your questions for Mark Ladner, 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing great, Dave. Thanks for having us, and thank you, The Hammer, for inviting us out here on the show to talk about our book. We're excited to be here. We're excited to see you, as always.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so why don't you give us a lowdown on your book? I can't touch it yet because I'm soaking wet.
Yeah. It's really crummy outside.
Yeah, and you know what? New York is like a choose your own crappy adventure when it rains. It's like, you know, especially you being tall, you're gonna get poked in the eye by some idiot's umbrella.
That's true. Chinatown is a dangerous place to go on any day.
Oh my god! And then like you know. There's construction everywhere in New York City all the time, but they put these, like, theoretically helpful things to stop, like, bricks from falling on your head, but they funnel you through these undrained things. Mm-hmm. So you're going a whole block under this thing with, like, a bunch of people with umbrellas, like, get your umbrella out of my way, get your umbrella out of my way, get your umbrella out of my way. And then at the last minute, like, there's a giant puddle that can't be jumped or forded or anything. And, of course, I'm not wearing waterproof shoes, right? Of course not. But the lady in front of you just stops. Like there's an alternative. Lady, turn back or go. Turn back or go. You know what I'm saying? And then when you get to the platform after you wait for the lady to go, of course, you see the... You see that subway pulling away because of that extra 5 seconds that lady stood there like a cow looking at the... That's the thing. People in New York...
Infuriating.
People in New York are like cattle. Like, just men and women walking around cow-like, staring off into space, moving slowly. Mm. Right? Nastasia, you hate that, right?
Yeah, I hate it. Hate it.
Hate. Nothing.
So, what'd you do with the poem?
No offense to cows.
Straight through?
I mean, what's the choice? I mean, what I did was one of my feet, I'm going to get wet, right? So I jump in, and like the first foot hits, I'm like, that's done, because I'm wearing sneaks. You know what I mean? They're like totally porous. They're meant to breathe. They're not meant, you know. And what's more fun, Mark, you'll know about this. What's more fun than walking around all day with a wet foot that never dries because it's, you know, raining out and humid? What's the best part?
Yeah, the fact that your foot will potentially never recover. Because I'm still suffering from the same athlete's foot I had probably 30 years ago, my first episode.
Wow. I didn't think about the permanent. I was thinking more of the sweet, sweet stench in the evening when you take off your, you know, like, you know, 8 hours, 9 hours, 10 hours later when you finally get home, you peel that wet shoe off your foot. This is why I tell my son Booker, socks, wear socks. New York is not a town for the sockless, unless you're one of these hipsters in those sandal things. But if you wear sneakers, if you wear a fully encased foot, you should put socks on that thing.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Seth?
Yes, yes.
At least you can always go with the Crocs. The porous confidence clog.
Listen, Mario Town coming in and talking to us about the Crocs. Are you allowed any color of Croc, or do you have to go orange when you're over there at Del Posto?
No, he has reserved the orange for himself.
So what's the Del Posto color? Like a nice navy
like
blue?
Like a black or blue, yeah.
What do you rock, the blue or the black?
I wear the Brigard slipper clog.
Ooh, is that with the black leather one? With the
black
nails?
They come in black or white.
But with the nails in the side?
Yeah.
That's pretty strong.
They're not wood, though. They're like slippers.
So it's like you're cooking in your jammies.
Exactly.
Should I buy you a silk chef's outfit? That would be sick.
That would be awesome. Like Sakai.
You imagine
used to rock that
really?
Stuff. Yeah.
Oh, my God. That would be amazing. Yeah. So I was talking to Jen, my wife, about this. I was like, you know, look. I was like, Dax, you know, like my skin right now is fundamentally, it's sandpaper. If I touched a silk garment with my fingers, it would like be instantly shredded. You know what I mean? Like all like the crusty, like callus and everything.
Yeah.
If it touched my face, it would just rip off and there'd be like, you know, silk mess all over my face. And any second.
The very first Iron Chef I ever did with Mario back many years ago, we did a collaboration with Sakai, the Japanese French chef, and he had like silk pajamas on and these like slipper clogs. The guy was like floating around Kitchen Stadium like he was Hugh Hefner or something.
That's
it was
so
unbelievable.
Awesome. So you have to shave yourself if you're going to do that, right?
Yeah, it was
and like sandpaper your hands. And
he really showed us how it's done.
Yeah, Jen told Dax he wasn't allowed to wear silk. She's like, you can't do it. I was like, what about silk jammies?
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of getting a pair of silk jammies. I mean, anything feel better than a silk jammy? I couldn't afford it when I was a kid. I was like, my mom's like, you can have that like weird satin stuff. What was that stuff made out of? It's like spun plastic. Silkette.
Most likely.
Yeah, you know, real flammable back in the 70s. You know, like in the 70s, they used to make kids' pajamas especially to catch on fire. You know what I mean? Like that's one way to get rid of them. Anyway, okay, so back to the book. Talk to me.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's a restaurant cookbook, Del Posto being a restaurant that's going, just entered its 12th year. So we have quite a bit of material that we wanted to cover. Michael and I have been spending the better part of, God, I think the first conversation might have been as long as 5 years ago. So
not with me. But.
Not with you. but it's been...
I came on the project quite, like last week. Like last
quite,
week.
Quite a process. And yeah, so, you know, we chose some dishes that we felt strongly about. And the interesting thing is that Michael really encouraged us to create a book that was approachable to the home cook, meaning getting rid of some of that professional restaurant speak. And so we actually did it in a very unorthodox way. We chose the dishes and photographed them first, and then spent close to 2 years going back and deconstructing and re-engineering all the recipes so that they contained, you know, sort of lay home kitchen language, which I guess the only negative part of that is that it creates very, very long recipes because to...
Long wording or like...
Long wording, exactly. So...
And they take a long time, too. These aren't quick weeknight recipes, but they do work.
They're broken into parts, and they are lengthy.
Our audience is not scared by this.
That's true. Actually, we're more scared about the questions they might ask us than them actually being able to complete the recipes. But, yeah, so they're incredibly thorough, and something that you probably don't see very often. And we spent a tremendous amount of energy, you know... laboring over the language to make sure that it was understandable for people that were enthusiasts but not necessarily experts.
So is 100-layer lasagna in there?
Of course.
Okay. Now let me add, you know, that's like what are your most favorite, like you show up at the restaurant,
that's a good
you get
one,
the
yeah.
you get the arancini with the gold thing,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
Is that
yeah.
in there?
Yeah, Marchese, it's in there.
Yeah. yeah. And then you got your 100-layer lasagna.
Yeah,
you got your little.
That's easy.
What about your house pastas? Are they in there?
We have a couple different recipes.
Your DP coins. What are those called?
I don't remember. We're working this new one now. That's actually little toys, so they're all different shapes, which is pretty interesting.
But extruded shapes or like actual physical?
No, they're stuffed shapes, but like mix match misty kind of thing. Yeah.
Like. Donkeys and puppets?
If only we had, you know.
Don't start 3D printing pasta, Mark. We'll have to have a fist fight right here.
People that nimble, if
you'll
only.
Beat me, I'm sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Where's this this centrifuge.
Well, we'll talk about it in a minute. We'll talk about it.
I want to see this thing.
Nastasia
says you carry it on your back like an infant. Is that true?
I did last week. I brought it here because we had to go to something. But like, I'm printing out some. I'm remaking the lid. So the centrifuge is designed to constantly feed new product in. So I had to print. So there's a thing called a feeder tube, part of the patented process of making the Spinzol. It's the reason why no one else can build the Spinzol the way we can do it, because we got a patent on it, or patent pending. Anyway, so it's this tube feeder that feeds the thing in, and that's what allows it to do continuous feeding. So I was building a new tube system on the bottom to, you know, increase the clarity of continuous versus batch mode. And I did like, I don't know, I did like... like 2.5 liters of strawberry in a row yesterday, and it was perfect. I actually took it to Oto. I was making strawberry cordial for the drinks that I was slinging at Oto last night. But it leads me to this. So, like, I'll just say, but we should talk about the book and then come back and talk about the centrifuge. talk about later.
That's about it. So it's, you know, broken down into chapters: antipasti, primi, secondi. Dolce, there's an entire chapter just on gelato and sorbetti, which is unusual.
And we have a question about that, actually.
Really? Okay, cool.
Yeah. You want to hear that question?
Sure, I'd love to.
All right. So, and didn't we have a question last week, Nastasia? But we answered it, right?
Yeah,
we theoretically
answered it.
But then do you, yeah.
I'm hoping that Chef Ladner is going to be on the show this week. Well, you are in luck, Ellie. I just received the Del Posto book this week and am enjoying it very much. What caught my eye are the gelato recipes. They use egg yolks but are not cooked. This seems peculiar. I like the word peculiar. You like the word peculiar?
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of Marvin Gaye.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This seems peculiar, and I've never seen it before. Why? Do they still thicken the mixture like a custard would? Are they left raw for texture or flavor? I'm looking forward to trying the recipes out soon, but would like to hear Dave and Mark's thoughts about this topic. Thanks, Ellie Nasser. Now, I have my own thoughts on this going way back from other, you know, from pastry chefs that I've known. One particular one. Sam Mason, actually.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But anyway, go ahead. Give your spiel.
Well, you know, definitely... You know, most of these recipes were at least initially formulated by Brooks Headley, the the pastry genius now at Superiority Burger. And then our current pastry chef, Justine McNeil, sort of completed the initial thought. But, you know, Brooks has always been a firm advocate of the hang and of the really chewy, viscous texture, so that it hangs around your mouth a little longer. You can taste it a little better. You know, you can really, similar to mayonnaise, you know, sometimes you're rolling the dice. You know?
On the safety, but what functionally? Why not cook it?
Graininess.
So, Sam Mason.
Yeah.
Back when I first got to know him after WD opened in like 03 or whenever it opened. Right around then, right? 02, 03. When I got to know him, I came to realize that he had a bunch of ice cream recipes where he wasn't cooking the egg yolks, but it was still a custard base. It wasn't Philly style. Basically, no one in New York makes Philly style. None of the big restaurants I know do a Philly style ice cream, which is weird. Even in a Paco Jet, you think someone would do a good Philly style ice cream. Maybe you can't. Maybe it overturns in a pot. I don't know. I haven't tried it. But anyway, I love good Philly ice cream. Do you like it?
I do, yes.
Yeah. But it has to be super fresh. Anyway, so I was like, yo, Sam, why you don't cook your egg yolks? And he's like, I don't like the aroma and taste of the cooked egg, but I like the texture, the smooth texture that the egg yolks bring. And so the deal with not cooking the egg yolks is what they're not going to bring is the thickness of a cooked creme anglaise. It's just not going to have that thickness. That said, the thicker you cook your creme anglaise, the more eggy it tastes. So you can't like win on that account. Like if you're trying to thicken up your anglaise base, and thickening an anglaise base is really good if you're going to serve it as a sauce, right? Or if you're really worried about meltdown. So like, you know, a thicker anglaise base will do a slower meltdown than a thinner anglaise base. And, you know, basically all this is creme. All these ice cream recipes is a flavored creme anglaise, right? Mm-hmm. So But what you pay for with that thickness is egg taste, and he hated it. He hated that egg taste, and you know what I'm talking about. If you, especially like for a pastry chef who cooks with eggs all day long, that residual egg nose that you get like after you wash out a stainless steel. You know when you wash out a stainless steel bain that's had eggs in it, and you're like freaking that egg smell. You know what I mean?
It's more like a sabayon or a hollandaise or something.
Yeah. So he didn't like it. So he didn't cook the eggs. And then later on, you know, he started pasteurizing the eggs low temp. So he would use pasteurized yolks.
That's good.
Yeah. So they would still they would be safe, but they ish. But they wouldn't have that cooked note, because you can take an egg yolk, you know, up to 57, pasteurize it for like an hour, and it still is raw smelling. You know what I mean? It doesn't have that cooked kind of egg thing.
Michael, do you remember any of the conversations happening when we were developing these recipes related to the yolks?
I remember it being brought up as a potential safety issue, and then we decided it probably really wasn't, that it would be pretty rare that anyone that was cooking out of this book was going to have a safety issue with their eggs. But also, if it tastes too eggy, it doesn't taste Italian. I mean, there isn't any sort of inherent egginess in Italian gelato.
Are your gelato recipes, like you said, Brooks likes the true, are they heavily stabilized?
Yeah.
So that's like true Italian. So like there's all these like people who are like true Italian. No, true Italian gelato has stabilized to the freaking gills.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you don't need the melt protection from a thick on glaze base when you are if you're going to add stabilizers.
Yeah.
One thing about adding stabilizers, obviously, depending on which stabilizers you use, is that you need to. You need to punch the flavors up. I mean, that's why, like, Italian flavors, they're smooth, but they're so punchy because they have to add so much flavor for that level of hit. Hey, you know what I want you to try?
Dulls.
You know what we should try sometime? Maybe in the next week or so? It's not, like, commercial quantity. Like, you couldn't do it in a restaurant, but the paste that's left over in the...
Oh, I can only imagine. Yeah, Nastassia and I were talking about that on the train today.
Yeah. Yeah, you take a centrifuge, you spin it, you get the paste, spin that into an ice cream.
Cool.
It's got like a grainy, like pumpkin pie texture, at least a peach that we did.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so freaking smooth and dense, because what you do is you take your fruit of choice, you hit it with the Pectin X, it wipes out the structure and everything. Well, and then it just the sweet potato is nuts. If we do the sweet, you even like the sweet potato puree. And Stassi hates everything. So the sweet potato puree, what you do with the sweet potatoes, you take the sweet potatoes, you cook it, right? And then you just blend the hell out of it with the same enzymes that distillers use to do saccharification for their warts and stuff, and you get this hyper, and then you spin it to get rid of the liquids, right? And then you just have this like hyper concentrated, super sweet, no sugar added sweet potato puree. Just add like a little cream to that mother and spin it. You want to do it?
I'm sure the applications are just infinite. We can do those purees.
We can make a small amount, like just in a KitchenAid, because you have LN over there at Del Posto. It would be fun, right?
Yeah.
Maybe we'll do it. Tell people about it. But like even just fruits like strawberry and whatnot, like you're just not used to having something that's so smooth but so high solids. I mean, that's the thing, so high. For instance, I'll give you an example. So when I did 1.75 kilos of strawberries yesterday in a batch to do continuous mode on my centrifuge, and I got 1350 mils of juice. So if you think about it, that's like 70. That's like 70 something percent yield, which means that the residuals that left over are solid.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
because
there's no
water.
At all.
Yeah, I mean, compared to what an original strawberry was. So like, anyway, it'd be fun to play with.
And is that just like a Driscoll regular available commercial?
You could say
strawberry.
Garbage strawberry. Yes, yeah, it was a garbage strawberry.
But it still tastes good.
Well, there are some advantages to garbage strawberries, and we could talk about that now. So I'll say something about the Spinzol. I should give the pitch, right?
Because yeah, please.
Nastassia is like, we're all nervous about this. So listen, so for those of you that don't know, we are pre-selling the Spinzol. The Spinzol. It's the only centrifuge designed specifically for the kitchen and bar. So we're pre-selling this thing for $6.99.
Make sure you check out the videos on Instagram. They're
Yeah, I'm going to put up some more. We have a bunch more videos that we're going to put up. In fact, I'm going to Chef Steps on Thursday.
Tomorrow.
I mean, on Wednesday. And then I guess maybe we're meeting with Kenji in San Francisco on Thursday. Nice. Try to push it out. We'll do a video on Facebook Live with the Chef Steps and show it. But
what does Nastasia's Spinzall pitch sound like?
Let's do it.
No, get a good one? Have it. Just buy it.
Come on, Stas.
Buy it.
That's Nastasia right there. So I'll say this. So, like, the Spinzall does 500 milliliters at a time batch, which is more than most home people need for most applications they're doing. But it also does what's called continuous mode, where you just stick the pipe, you stick a tube in it, it pumps it through and just feeds it through and continuously operates it. And so, like, orange juice, you could probably do... You could probably do, like, I don't know, a gallon or two at a time without stopping.
And then what would you know to change the basket?
It depends on the solids ratio. So for something like strawberries, I probably wouldn't do more than, like, three liters maybe at a time because you don't want the solids to overflow the rotor.
Sure.
But something like lime juice or grapefruit juice or orange juice, gallons, because there's not a lot of solids in there. So really everything depends on what you're doing. Really, the best application, one of the best, I'll give you some applications for chefs. Let's forget the bar application. By the way, I will say this. You go to modernistpantry.com/Spinzall to pre-order it. Now, I want to say something to people so they get this. If you do not pre-order, if we do not sell 1,000 of these pre-order, then we can't afford to build it, and we won't build it unless some angel comes in, which we don't expect, right? So if we don't sell 1,000 of them, they just don't get made. I mean, that's it. And then I'm just left with that one prototype, wah, wah. I call the people in China that Nastasia and I have been working with for 2 years on this project and tell them, you know what? Sorry, folks. We fold it up. We walk away. I mean, jeez. That's unfortunately, yeah, I mean, that's what's going to happen. Yeah. So if you don't order it, we won't build it. But here's one of the people. Someone came up to me. I'm not going to say who it is. It was Don Lee, the cocktail guy. Then he goes up to me. He's like, hey, Dave. Hey, why didn't you just use Kickstarter? Why didn't you just kickstart this? Why you got to use your own crowdfunding that's
Wow.
So Don doesn't talk like that, by the way. But the point is here's the reason, one of the reasons why. With Kickstarter, part of it was... Nastasia, I mean, to be honest, Nastasia hates Kickstarter, but she hates everything. She hates biscuits. Like, that's going to stop me from making biscuits, right? But the point is, we're really taking the risk on ourselves, and this is what I think is not clear. With a Kickstarter, if the campaign gets funded, all of your money is gone into a hole, and then you either get the product or you don't. Depending on whether or not the people who are making it are competent, blah, 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 that money is gone. You can't get it back. That's part of the thing about Kickstarter. One of the reasons we did this is we didn't want people to feel like they were taking a risk. It's one of the weird kind of incorrect notions that people have about they feel safer on Kickstarter somehow because I know about Kickstarter, right? So they feel safer on it, even though literally as soon as that campaign is over, your money goes into a pit that may or may not, and you may or may not ever get your reward.
Well, the other misconception is that money earned on Kickstarter is free money, which it most certainly
is not. It's not. But in our campaign, you can get a refund up till the very point at which we ship you the unit. So there is zero risk to pledge in the Spinzall campaign. Zero risk. So you pledge now, what you're telling us is that we're going to spend the money, right, because we need to build the Spinzalls, but at some point you're like, you know what? It turns out I hate awesome things. It turns out that, like, it turns out I am an enemy of quality after all. And, you could be like, you know what, Dave? You know what, Nastasia? I want my money back. And we're like, okay, fine. Boom. Here's your money back. And that's one of the main reasons we did it is that the risk is on us. So you should feel like super safe going out there and getting it anyway. And remember, you don't buy it. We don't build it.
So what are some of the other applications aside from bar programs?
Right. So what Reni Redzepi, did I tell you about the thing with like everyone who's chasing stars? We're like back in the day.
Michelin stars.
Or anything. But the thing is, what does he have? Does he have two or three at NoMA?
He has two.
But he's got like the Pellegrino, like he was the top restaurant in the universe, which I hate all those ratings, right? I detest them. They're stupid. They make unless we have one. You know what I'm saying? It's like the idea of I like anything that helps the people I know or good people like get more business. I'm for people getting business, and if if like awards and like accolades like this are what it takes for people to go to someone's restaurant who works hard, great. You know what I mean? Anyway.
Look at those. It helps.
It helps, yeah. I mean, like, I wish that wasn't what helped, but it does. And so, therefore, I'm glad when, you know, my friends get these things. But, you know, Fabulous and Jeremiah got their first Michelin star recently.
Well deserved.
Yeah. Yeah.
At
Contra.
Doing really well.
Contra got the star, right?
Yes, Contra.
Yeah.
Although Wild Air deserved one as well.
Yeah, because, I mean, they're joined kitchens, basically. They share, they're, like, not joined, but, like, there's a, just one wall between them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, not talking about that. Mm-hmm. So
Protégés of yours, though.
What?
Protégés of
yours. Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah. What were we talking about? Oh, wait, Renny Redzepi. So Renny, we used to, Nastassi and I, when, like, someone was, like, trying to get all those awards, we'd be like, and we didn't think that someone was going to get it, we'd be like, yo, wake up and smell the Redzepi. You know what I mean? Because it's like you know, hey, buddy, you're not going to get there. You're not going to be Renny Redzepi. Wake up and smell it. You know what I mean? Just be yourself. Anyway. So that's neither here nor there. So Ariel Johnson, who was at the Nordic Food Lab for many years before she moved to MIT recently, she said that one of the main things that they do in the Centrifuge is herb oils.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they do crazy herb oils. So, like, I asked her, they do, like, almost, like, one-to-one herb to... herb to oil, so it's like pesto thick,
yeah.
Right? And then they spin the solids off. So, like, I don't do it that thick because I think it's kind of absurd, and I'm not, like, you know, I'm not trying to. But we'll do, like, I'll do, like, two to one, so it's basically pesto. You know,
you take all the water out, and it's super stable.
Yes. So what you do is you blend. You can, like, in the Spinzol, you can blend any oil batch that has up to about 400 grams of herb. Like, its sweet spot is around, like, 2 or 3, like, 300 grams of herb, and then you know, the balance oil. But it can be any amount of oil you want. It doesn't have to be within the 500. And then you add, like, so you just subtract out the weight of the rotor. So let's say you use 400 grams of herb. You take, like, 75 grams of water, put it right in the Spinzol, start it, and then feed the oil in. All the water goes into the rotor, and you get this pure, intense, green, highly stable herb oil with no water in it. And it's like, you can't possibly make this herb oil without a Centrifuge unless you sit there and you twist, you know, like one of those fine bags, and you get, like, 3 drops. You're not going to get any yield. We get something like 80% of the oil back. So it's like,
wow.
Like, super awesome. And so I did a pasta, actually, with I did a basil oil and a parsley oil and mixed them. And just because my kids are like, I don't want any like herbs in my pasta, but I love that kind of fresh parsley or fresh basil thing. So just toss the oil in. Yeah, did it with the finishing oil, toss it off with that, and they were like, they didn't complain because they actually don't dislike the taste. They dislike the idea of a leaf.
Green leaf, yeah.
In their
that's
freaking
common.
Product.
That's common.
Yeah, yeah. Anyways, so that's good. I really like, again, maybe not for restaurants, but I really like Centrifuge butter. Wiley used to make Centrifuge butter because it's...
Yeah, we're really excited about it. Seeing that today, but we couldn't find any cream in any of these hipster stores out here.
Well, I'll come to Del Posto's, like, when I get back. Maybe, like, I don't know what your schedule is. I'll come back maybe next week when I'm back.
Sounds great.
Yeah, the butter is good. Another classic chef one, I'll tell you. So you take a fruit, right? And let's say you want to make a really reduced like, fruit thing. This is what I brought. So, like, the garbage strawberries I had yesterday, what's good about them is they're relatively low Brix, which means if you they have low sugar. And the good news about that is that you can boil it way the hell down before the temperature gets too high, so it stays pretty close to the regular boiling point, so it doesn't get brown notes. And you can reduce it way down and then dope the sugar.
And it won't caramelize.
No, yeah, right. And then at the end, you hit the sugar back in to balance out the acid, because a garbage strawberry is low Brix, high acid. But I didn't reduce it enough. But yeah, you could try it. I didn't reduce enough. I could have gone twice as much. But you can't reduce strawberry puree with pectin in it, right? So
okay.
So I only reduced this by, like, twice. I could have done it by, like, 4 and, you know, and hit it with some sugar. But, or you could hit it with a hydrocolloid.
Kind of tastes like shit, Dave.
You like it?
No, I'm kidding.
Really?
Tastes really good.
I mean, it's good, right?
Yeah.
I mean, but you could have reduced it, like, it's like jam almost. But anyway, so, like,
it's really fruity. It's really bright. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah. So, like, but I could have, like I say, reduced it by another, like, if I had taken, literally, I was like, I thought about this as I was walking out the door. I was already late. So I put my widest fry pan on my stove, cranked it, dumped the strawberry, and was like, tried to take it as fast as I could. And then, like, as I knew I was going to Well, in fact, I missed that Subway, the one that would get me here on time. I poured it into that container, took a couple spoonfuls of sugar, was like, shook it and came.
But and there's no residual flavors from the enzymes or any
of zero.
That? Zero.
I mean, you're using like 0.2 to 0.4%. They have a vaguely kind of a fermented aroma, but they're, you know, and this one only uses one enzyme anyway.
Also, the color is so brilliant.
Right?
It's incredible.
Dave, did you say what the size of the device is of the Spinzol?
It's about the size of a food processor. Here's the thing. If you look, here's the other thing, right? Let's say you want to have a centrifuge in your restaurant or bar, right? What are you going to do? You're going to invest $8,000 on something that takes up half of your prep area? No. That requires training for someone to balance it?
Yeah.
No. Because here's the other thing. Let's say you could afford it, right? Now, Mark, what's the worst thing that happens when you're relying on a piece of equipment?
Some knucklehead goes and tries to use it when they're not qualified.
And they break it. Then you're out two things. You're out the money, and all of a sudden you're 86 on all the products that use
exactly.
it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, you can't make it on another way, right?
Right. So you have two or three VitaPreps, so when a knucklehead breaks the VitaPrep, which invariably happens...
That's exactly what we do.
Yeah, you have another VitaPrep there.
Yeah.
So the good thing here is you can test out to see whether you like having a centrifuge, right? Mm-hmm. And then you could get a backup because they're so cheap compared to, like, the big-size centrifuge. Mm-hmm. You know, anyway, that's... Because I think that, like, when I was thinking about it, like, one of the main... aside from the size and the cost, is just the lack of backup. I was so nervous. Like I always had two centrifuges, real ones, big ones, at Booker mm-hmm. and Dax because mm-hmm. I needed them.
Mm-hmm.
And when one died and we were down to one, I was constantly on edge that it was going to die. It in fact did die, and I had to borrow Wiley's centrifuge. And so like I borrowed his centrifuge, but it's a real kind of a nightmare to be so dependent on such a large, 300-pound thing that costs, you know, $8,000. It's very...
And a lot of your production is coming out of it.
Yeah. I mean, like, well, some 80% of our menu had something that's gone through the centrifuge. Like, not necessarily, like, huge quantity, but, like, all the clarified citrus, all the, all those things.
So and some of that stuff won't take the carbonation properly if it's not clear.
Oh, none of it. You need to clarify everything that you're going to carbonate, especially if you're going to pre-carbonate. I mean, if you're going to squeeze a lime into something afterwards, I mean, fine. But, you know, if anything you're going to pre-carb, you need that. And plus I just enjoy clear things. Anyways, so those are like,
So for example, at your new bar, how many of these Spinzols would you perhaps have on premise?
Four. Because mm-hmm. if you have four, that matches the actual like real time capacity of the big centrifuge, but you could task it with four different products or you could do continuous. So if you have four mm-hmm. Spinzols, you have the actual like real time, it's actually faster because they clarify faster than a normal centrifuge because they have less distance to go. So, you're actually at a faster throughput with four Spinzols than you are with one 10,000.
You don't have to worry about the balancing.
No balancing. Yeah, you can run the product separately. You can open it. You can look at it while it's running.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's what I'm going to do. I'm not even going to buy... When we reopen, which, by the way, I'm looking at space, but when we reopen, it won't be called Booker and Dax, though, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what's going to be called. Do you have any good bar names?
I don't know. What did you say the Arnold name means again?
What's that called? I focused on some of the people at the bar last night. Eagle Power, and they were like, no. I was like, here's how it works. Here's where Eagle Power is, right? So you walk into whatever the actual bar name is, right? Whatever it is, right? What do you think about Rochambeau?
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, so you walk into Rochambeau, and you're like, I want to go to Eagle Power. And we take you downstairs into like a little like boiler room thing with just one seat, and like you are at the Eagle Power bar. Like, that's it. You are Eagle Power. Or alternatively, we just like clear your service. So you know how when you walk in, like we give you the glass, we give you the everything, right? You just say, Eagle Power. And we clear your service and your menu, hand you like a special service and the Eagle Power, and we put like a box around you. So you are in the Eagle Power zone there. The other specialty bar, because we could have multiples if Creamy Tins. Because I have so many recipes with like cream syrups and we're like Creamy Tins. Because that's a bartender's worst nightmare.
Yes.
Is Creamy Tins worst. Okay. So, should we take a break?
Yeah.
Well, let's take a break. Come back with more Del Posto and cooking issues.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Joule, the immersion circulator for sous vide by Chef Steps. If you're listening to this show, you're probably a pretty good cook. Maybe you already know that sous vide is the best way to get a kick-ass juicy steak. And with Joule, a new sous vide tool from Chef Steps, you can do so much more. Smoky tender ribs, homemade yogurt, creme brulee, bright crunchy pickles, vibrant purees, even smooth creamy ice cream, all perfectly cooked every time. Joule is sleek and small enough to fit in your kitchen drawer, and it's operated by an elegant smartphone app that's been designed to remove the guesswork, get you cooking faster, and give you the information and inspiration you want when you want it. Browse Chef Steps' amazing recipes and helpful guides. Choose your perfect doneness for any meat and get notified when your food is ready. You know you'll get great results, so you can focus on sides and sauces, or just pour yourself a cocktail and chill until you're ready for a delicious dinner. For more information and to order yours now, visit chefsteps.com/joule. And we are back. So, actually, Mark, you saw us use the spins all right live.
I did. Yeah. I was super impressed because I had seen just video of some of the earlier prototypes, and the thing looked like it was going to take off to Mars. I was scared for your life trying to operate that thing. But this other one is like really tame. It's quiet. It's like the spin is like a pleasant noise.
Yeah, and you value. Some
quality?
Sort of calm in the kitchen.
Quality.
Yeah, quality.
I value quality.
But you're a calm cook, right? I mean, you get when things go wrong, you get sad, right? Not like
Like,
oh, the food.
No, I throw tantrums from that now and then.
I picture you more as the...
It takes too much energy.
Yeah.
People realize that's not the way to operate.
You've hurt the food.
Years ago.
You hurt the food. Why did you hurt the food?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, my general philosophy is to remove variable for error from the equation prior to service, so that when you're in service, you can just go.
And are most of the times those variables for error the cooks? I'm just messing with you.
Not our cooks.
I've met a bunch of your cooks. Your cooks are fantastic.
Yes, yeah. Thank you, Dave.
How many do you have? 8 million?
Yeah, quite a few.
Like, seriously, how many people work?
Many dozens. Many dozens. It's,
but you, like, over 100 people work there, right?
200.
200, yeah. 200 people work there. And you have, what, 8,000
like
seats?
60 in the kitchen.
Yeah, you have 8,000 seats? How many seats do you have?
400 seats.
Come on, really?
Yeah.
400 seats.
Yep.
That's like a high school.
It's big.
Yeah. Like, a whole high school could have their graduation, if they had the money, the whole high school could have their graduation party
there. It's 24,000 square feet. So it could actually be many more seats. So I'm actually considering myself fortunate to only have 400.
Yeah. So also, like, I was thinking about this the other day because, and we've talked about this. Remember WD-50?
Of course I do.
Wiley's restaurant. Wiley's restaurant was, kitchen-wise, a cook's paradise.
It was crazy. It was.
Like, his ratio of back to front of house, I was like, a kitchen that luxurious will never be replicated again. Mm-hmm. But then your kitchen is pretty freaking luxurious. I mean, it is. I mean, but you do a lot of work in there. It doesn't necessarily go out to the floor, right? Or is it just very luxurious? I mean, you just have like a super luxurious.
The actual story that probably most people don't know about was that one time I took a walk with Mario early on during the demolition phase before the construction actually started, and he simply took a look at the room. And took his orange clog and drew an imaginary line and said, no dining room past this point. And that's how the kitchen was done.
And you're like, what am I going to do with all this space? He's like, I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care.
Pretty much, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what is it like just basically like not having to be in kind of crushing evil death for kitchen? What's that like?
It's palatial. I mean, that's one of the things that I realized, before I accepted the position was that, you know, if I'm going to be working in this profession as a chef, I'm going to be working many hours and I'm going to be toiling away, and I might as well be in a nice environment. It's bigger than it needs to be, and I don't think necessarily all the young cooks really appreciate what that means and what reality is like, because it's not reality. But we just try to be sort of, you know, gracious about it and not take it for granted. And, we're lucky.
I mean, assuming you can do your numbers on the front of house because you have more than enough space, right, for what you want to do. So assuming that, like, and I guess the bigger your space is, the lower the rent per square foot is probably, right? So assuming you can juggle the numbers, do you think that having a really nice, in other words, like pleasant kitchen it makes the restaurant more sustainable because you have less turnover?
No.
You have the same turnover, you think? You don't think they appreciate it?
No. I don't think it matters.
You get a lot of people who leave and they're like, man, I wish I hadn't left, and they come back?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah?
Actually, that happens quite a bit, which is pretty great. I love that.
And do you then punish them for having left?
No, I mean, we also treat our people well. You know, we believe in a new sort of world order of altruistic business and personnel management, you know, so we treat people well.
Have you met your girlfriend, Nastasia?
Yep. She's the enemy of altruism.
It is not true.
No, she's. It's not that. She, no, look. Let's be fair to Nastasia. It's not that she. It's that's not it. It's that she just enjoys stirring the pot so much that she can't.
That's true.
She can't stand.
That is true.
Like a lack of strife. If there's no strife, she's not happy. Yep. Peter Kim from Museum of Food and Drink has coined a term for you. Are you familiar with it?
I don't think so.
Stasenfreude.
Yeah. That is a good one.
It's a genius term.
It works
right?
So well.
Yeah.
Get to that.
Oh, yes. Okay. So, you know, since I feel like we're on freaking NPR, we're just asking people for money constantly. Buy my Spinzall. Buy. You should buy the Del Posto book. Not a big investment. How much does it cost?
$50.
And you get it away.
You can get it way cheaper.
How much is it on Amazon?
Like 25, maybe.
Really?
No, it's like 40.
Really?
40?
Yeah.
They only cut you $10, huh? Yeah.
You can get it for like $12 at the Strand.
No, Strand, listen. Nastasia and I, we've gone, they sold all the ones they had. Listen. The Strand used to be a freaking mecca. I still go.
Yeah.
I love going and like looking at it. But in this internet era, it used to be that everything at the Strand was half off, basically. You know what I mean? Even new stuff was like half off. And like they would take old books and they would mark it half off of what it cost in like 1963. And so I would pick up, my old LaRousse, my old Pelleprat, you know the old like Pelleprat French, the classic French one? I picked up my 70s edition there for nothing, $5. You know what I mean? And then, you know, as the internet started creeping in and as price checking happened, as all these, their prices actually creeped up. So
they probably got a rent increase. So
I don't know, man. You don't think they own that building? I mean, they must own that building. My point is that it's not the bargain that it used to be. I still love going there. I used to like more going there when it was so piss hot in the summer because it wasn't air conditioned back in the day. And the employees would almost like shoot you as soon as talk to you because it was just so freaking hot. Everyone was just dripping and it smelled like hot, wet, humid book all summer. And what I liked about it is there was no people there. And you know how I like, you know, how I hate dealing with, you know, people. So I was like, you know, I love it. Yeah, that's freaking, get out of my way. I'm trying to look at books. Get out of my way. You know what I mean? You want to hate? Anyway, I'm not going to get into this. I'm like, you know, dude, I'm looking. Get away. You know what I mean? Or like, you know what I hate also? This is another one. I hate when, like, you're being quick and you're not really in the way and the person gives you the excuse me. If there's an excuse me because they don't want to touch you, whatever, but they're like, excuse me, I need – you know, you're like, no, I'm also doing this. By the way, I am getting so much meaner in the kitchen I found over the years because I've taken the same attitude with my family that I take with, like, anyone when I'm in even a regular kitchen. And I've just realized at Thanksgiving – oh, we got to talk about Thanksgiving. I just realized at Thanksgiving that why they think I'm a jerk, because when you're in a kitchen and you say, excuse me, what that means is, I'm about to continue walking through you unless you move. It doesn't mean I'm going to wait for you to move out of my way. It means this tray of stuff is headed in a straight line, and if you're in that line, you're going to get shouldered. Like, even if it's your family, that's what it means. That's what excuse me means in the context of a kitchen. Am I right about this, Mark? It's not rude. It's not about
behind politeness. You or beside you or.
Well, yeah, but like they don't even understand. But like,
we used to smack people on the ass, but you can't do that anymore.
Oh, in exchange, I know. Anyway, but you get my point. I told you about the guy. I met a guy who almost died. This is another thing going back to the stupid bro crap in the kitchen that we were talking about last week. I hate the spoon to the nuts trick. I don't like. You know what?
That's terrible.
I hate it. I've always hated it. First of all, it hurts like hell, and I don't get it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm okay with like a nice pat on the shoulder.
It's assault.
It is a pat on the shoulder, but like the whole like grabbing someone's junk from underneath, from behind, or the hitting with the spoon. So I met a guy who got spooned in the nuts and got an infection. Got blood poisoning and almost died as a result of
cracked nut.
Yeah, from a spoon hit to the nuts. And it's just you know, if you weren't going to get rid of the bro stuff in the kitchen to make it like a decent place to work for women, like do it for your own nuts. You know what I mean? Like the nut you save may be your own.
I don't see that stuff happening so much anymore.
Well, good.
Yeah.
It's stupid. It's also like being constantly on edge that you're about to get hit in the nuts with a spoon when you're trying to work is not conducive to good work. You know what I mean?
It's true.
How do we get to this?
No, be the thing.
Oh, yeah.
Did you do the charity bus thing yet? Oh, come on.
No, all right. So this is over. Dave, when's this over, this thing?
Thursday at 3.
What's the website, Dave?
Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. The URL is...
And not a Dave Arnold 3, like 3 on the dot.
3:02 p.m. Yeah. Eastern Time. It's charitybuzz.com. Wait, that's a long URL.
Oh, Jeebus.
Hold on.
Oh, God. All right, well, it's...
charitybuzz.com/support/heritageradio.
You want to throw any asterisks and, like, numbers?
That's
like
it.
-123-9?
I'll say it one more time. charitybuzz.com/support/heritageradio.
I mean, it ain't no Miner's Pantry /Spinzall in terms of tripping off the tongue. You know what I'm saying?
Oh.
Anyway. But, like, here's what you're going to get. So, Nastasia and I have apparently donated this. This is what you get. Your experience will take place on a mutually agreed upon date between December 1st, 2016 and December 1st, 2017. Experience will occur on a mutually agreed upon Tuesday. This is valid for one person and has an approximate duration of 3 hours. This is a private meet and greet. The winner may take a photo. Of course the winner can take a freaking photo. Nastasi, why don't you just tell them, what do they get?
You get to go on the radio show with us and then you get to eat lunch with us.
It makes a lot of sense. All this... Cost of the meals included. The experience cannot be resold or re-auctioned. I mean, please. Was that really going to happen?
The estimated value is $5,000.
What?
We have one bid for $500.
Yeah, that's...
Getting there.
Yeah, 10%. All right. Whatever. That's a lot. Just to come on the radio show?
Yeah.
Really?
And have lunch with you.
Yeah, that's the value.
If only I told my kids, you know what? You should sit and finish your lunch. You know why? This is $5,000 that you're throwing away right here. Anyway, go on, donate some stuff.
On a Tuesday.
On a Tuesday. Lunch on a Tuesday. The most expensive pizza you will ever buy is to come eat with Nastasia and I. So anyway, so back to, what were we talking, kitchens,
yeah.
Thanksgiving.
Yeah, we don't have that much time.
Okay, let me do this question real quick. From Tom Fisher in Philly. Last summer in 2015, I spent about a month making large amounts of clarified strawberry and raspberry juice in my centrifuge and stored it, not in a Spinzall though, that wasn't a Spinzall, and stored it in my refrigerator in my garage, intending to make syrup later. I made the strawberry syrup, but never got around to making the raspberry. Imagine my surprise when today I found about 2 liters of raspberry juice at the back of that fridge. It's still crystal clear and smells delicious. The question is it safe? You see the movie The Marathon Man? Mm-hmm. Great movie. Is it safe? Remember that? Awesome.
Dustin Hoffman
and oh my God, his name went out of my head. The Is It Safe guy, the dentist. Oh my God, crazy. I'm losing my mind. It's like gone. Not losing, lost. It's still crystal clear and smells delicious. Gosh. The question is it safe? Given how many raspberries it took to make that much juice, I'm hesitant to just throw it away. Drink that sucker. What you have is raspberry wine, my friend. If you've sealed it well enough, it'll probably be carbonated and you'll probably see a yeast layer at the bottom. But I've had OJ that I've left in my fridge for months and months just to let it ripen up, and that stuff is good.
And the soda that you make is amazing.
Yeah, and it won't kill you. It won't kill you. So, I mean, look, if you reply next week that it was delicious, I'm assuming that I was right and you didn't die. But I'm just saying that I would eat it if I were you. So Mark, what did you do on the Thanksgiving?
I went to Boston and saw my family and enjoyed someone else cooking for Thanksgiving.
Good. How overcooked was the turkey?
It was overcooked.
Yeah.
It was. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I brought with me though to save the day one of those M. Wells tortillas. Do you know these things?
No.
That Hugh and Sarah make.
No.
Brightest with the
what is it,
cranberry
like
ketchup.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's like this Canadian meat pie.
Oh, I like meat
lots
pie.
Lots of offal and lots of lard in the crust and
sounds
obscene.
Good. Sounds
best
good.
Thing ever.
Yeah. Stars, your Thanksgiving?
Portland with my brother and my family.
How was the turkey?
It was good, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Michael, you?
South Coast, Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah?
What turkey was good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What style of stuffing do they make there? You're not some sort of weird oyster stuffing person, are you?
No. Just like celery, bread, onions.
Sausage in that thing?
Nope.
Whoa, no sausage in your stuffing?
No.
Sausage in your stuffing, Mark?
No, sir.
Sausage in your stuffing? Stas is like, yeah, American, hello. But by the way, while I'm telling you what I did, I want you guys to think on this. Are we the country of gravy? Is there any other country that makes American-style awesome gravy? I'm not talking about, like, Sunday gravy for you Massachusetts people, Italian, like, gravy, which is actually sauce. But does anyone make American-style, I want to call it kind of God's gravy. Gravy. Real gravy. Anyway, while you're thinking about that, here's what I did. This maybe was the smoothest without a hitch Thanksgiving ever. What I did was I bought 3 14 to 16 pound turkeys instead of one giant one. Mm-hmm. I took two of them, boned them out, cut them all into chicken sized pieces. So I salted them down and cooked them in milk, small amount of milk and sugar under vac till they were cooked. Pulled them, ripped the tendons out of the leg pieces, so now we're all boneless except for the thing. Took them out hot, let them flash off on racks so that the skins got real nice and dry. And then I buttermilk breaded them like chicken fried turkey pieces. Then I took the other turkey that was left whole, because you need to present a whole bird, but it was only like 14 or 15 pounds, so it's easy. Let it air dry for when I took all the bones that I ripped out of the other birds, I hacked them up, cooked them in the, roasted them, made a double pressure cooker stock, so one half the bones, started with chicken stock, one half the bones, boom, vent, boom, another one, boom, freshened up the veg in that, and then took some of that, injected that, added a little salt, injected that into the whole bird, into the breast,
wow,
so
nice.
Brining it with its own, with its own cannibal brine,
yeah.
And then let that air dry for a couple of hours, turn the other stuff back into gravy with the roux. I misjudged a little bit how much roux, so I had to add some Bermini at the end. You know what I mean? Sorry about that. Anyway, so then I had the chicken. So then I deep fried at a lower temperature the whole bird in my commercial deep fryer outside.
Damn.
With propane. Deep fried that whole bird till it was done, and then pulled that. And then while that was resting at the table, did all the, cranked the temperature and did all the pre-cooked chicken fried turkey, and then pulled it out. So we had this giant table full of turkey, a lot of turkey.
I can only imagine the turkey frying explosion you could be responsible for.
This is why I air dried it.
So awesome.
Yeah, the trick with the, first of all, with any bird that you're going to fry, whole fry, I think a lot of the mistake people make is they dry it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Otherwise, you get really kind of nightmare scenarios. And the other thing is that when you're frying in a commercial deep fryer as opposed to in one of those, the problem with the turkey fryers that they sell you where you're cooking in those 5-gallon jugs and you go down is that it orients the turkey such that if you have any moisture on the inside, you create a fountain. And I think that's what a lot of the reasons they overfill the oil and they get this like boiling fountain effect coming through the center of the turkey and it overflows.
And miscalculate the displacement.
Yeah.
Of oil, right?
Yeah. Whereas in a commercial deep fryer, you're going horizontally, so you still get some foam up, but it's not a big deal. In fact, the top of the breast was out a little bit, so we were ladling over the top to get it done, which is actually not bad because that part of meat you don't want overcooked anyway. So back to the gravy question.
Smart.
Does anyone do gravy the way we do gravy?
I don't know. Is it like a Creole thing? Did it come from New Orleans?
I don't know. But it's like,
I mean, they like their roux for sure.
Yeah.
Now, Nastasia, if you don't like gravy, that might be the end. Do you like gravy?
Really?
Oh my freaking God. Oh my freaking God. Oh.
What do you like, Nastasia?
I like lots of things. I don't like gravy.
Do you like mashed potatoes?
Yes, no gravy.
But thank God, I'm sure Mark puts enough butter and cream to kill five horses.
I do.
Wait, are you an anti-cream in your mashed potatoes guy, Mark?
No, I think dairy is helpful.
No, but so I know some people, I'm not going to mention them, Wiley, who is like, butter only. I don't want to add any liquid to my potatoes. I want to add all of the viscosity with butter, Robuchon style.
It helps.
But I like cream in my
emulsion.
I like the cream in it, yeah. I bought
milk or
Yeah. I hate food mills, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, I hate
them. For potatoes.
For potatoes. I detest them. I hate them. JJ, who used to work for Wiley, is now doing Ando. He, when a couple of years ago, he was cooking a feast with his mom. His mom handed him a food mill. He opened the door to her house and threw the food mill out into the... I am convinced. So food mill is one of the biggest enemies of quality that's out there in terms of your life. I don't think there's any cook who likes food mills that uses
true.
Them. No,
it's not true.
You have cooks that will use the food mill for you. When was the last time you stood there and, like, took the food mill and you're cranking it, and there's only that tiny freaking wedge that works, and it gets clogged, and then you have to back it up every 2 seconds. It takes 18,000 years. You're scalding your knuckles. The bowl's sliding around. It's garbage. And I know they use it at Del Posto every freaking day because I was talking to your cooks at Oto last week.
Not for starch, though.
No, but for tomatoes. They make tomato strainers, dude. It's like...
No, it's not the same.
Wait, you're telling me that your cook's putting the tomatoes through a food mill is better than one of those mechanical, like, KitchenAid tomato strainers or the large version of it?
I don't know what that is.
I'll tell you what it is. It's a lot freaking easier to use than a food mill.
Well, I have to get one. Well, what else are they going to do? There's like 60 of them. They got to do something.
That's true. It's like, I hate food mills. I think anyone that actually has to use them hate them. So I bought a really good ricer. I bought, because I've told you this.
Ricers.
I like potatoes in a ricer. Some people don't like
that's
them.
That's how I do
them. I love rice potato because it you're going to break up those little rice pellets as you stir, but it like maintains as much texture as you want. I think I love the rice.
It doesn't get like a last, I don't know, there's something about it that's just right with the ricer.
The problem is I've broken every single ricer I've ever used because I'm just like I'm an animal somehow on equipment. It's not that I'm physically strong, but I can break anything, especially if there's a lever arm on it. So I bought the...
I've seen you take down a tree.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I bought the cast aluminum one because I thought it wasn't going to bend. And so far, Norpro, yeah, Norpro makes a stainless one, but someone was like, I bought the stainless one and it bent. So I was like, I'm going to go with the cast one. And if it breaks, I'll go get the stainless steel one. So you want me to tell you how I did the potatoes this year? All right. So what I love, the way I break my ricers is cook the potatoes. I roast the potatoes in their jackets, right? And then I rice them whole. Then I save the squashed skins and I fry them up as a leftover.
Nice.
Right?
Yeah, that's good.
But it's a huge pain in the ass and you have to cut all these hot potatoes and like nightmare and all this. So this year what I did was I peeled all the potatoes like standard, foil wrapped them, threw them in the oven, baked them so they wouldn't take on any extra water. And you could do a long bake without them breaking apart. Then all you had to do is like quick snap the foil off and throw them in the ricer. Boom, 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 boom. And you never had to clean out your ricer because it didn't have all of those skins on the inside.
Interesting.
So that was my Skizzle's trick on the potatoes. Huh. Anyway, that was that's Thanksgiving at my house. Thanks to Michael and Chef Mark Ladner for coming in and talking marginally. It's like pulling teeth getting you guys to talk about your cookbook. Go buy the freaking cookbook. Learn how to make the fabulous 100-layer lasagna. Oh, on the way out, here's what I didn't ask you. So you rejiggered all the talk and the way the recipes are organized for home folk.
Yes. Yes.
And I will vouch for you, knowing you for many years, that you don't like things that aren't the way you want them, right?
Sure.
Yeah. And so... I'm sure that you put in 8 boatloads of work to ensure that the results that the people are going to get are pretty damn close to what you want them to get if they follow your instructions. Is that true? Do you feel you've achieved the same?
In all honesty, Michael put in more of the time than I did, but I would absolutely agree that it's like, yes.
So it might not be the
same amount of work that went into this book.
But I'm saying, like, so if someone wants to make the 100-layer lasagna here, the workflow might not be the same because workflow in a restaurant is different from workflow at home, right?
Sure.
And, like, the plaza is different. Everything's different. But if they follow the instructions, they are going to and they're not enemies of quality.
Yes.
They will be able to produce with this recipe.
Absolutely no question.
The recipes were tested like 3 times, each one. I mean, each piece of the recipes were tested as we went along, but then the final recipe was tested 3 times, once in metric, once in American, and all of this was done, all the final testing was done on a 4-burner stove in an apartment with our recipe tester.
Nice.
So it works.
You ever set off the detectors, the smoke detectors?
Sure.
Nice.
Yeah.
Many times.
The cooking
detectors. But the point is that it works. So we know it works because we literally did it. As if someone at home would be doing
it. And the language is digestible, although long.
And dirty secret, by the way, that I guess is not a secret, everybody knows it, is that, like, most cookbooks, ain't nobody testing those recipes.
That's true.
Your editors aren't like, did you test the recipes?
No.
Editors don't care. Like they
Shockingly.
Yes. I mean, like, you know, my editor cares, but like the vast majority of people, they don't care. So like a lot of the cookbooks you get out there, they're just completely untested recipes, especially, just not knocking chefs, but like what happens is chefs, you know, don't have a lot of time. And so what happens is that you have your internal specs,
yeah,
and then you try to butcher those internal specs directly into a home recipe.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
It doesn't freaking work.
Yeah.
You know, what
also because there's a conceit of like, oh, well, they'll never even get this piece of equipment. They'll never even be able to really get this ingredient the way we want it. So why bother? I'm talking about cookbooks from, you know, restaurants like Del Posto, sort of the top tier stuff. So they say, well, really, this we should just write this down because it's another outline for chefs and for people to look at how the food is put together and all that stuff. There's some cookbooks out there where the fine print in the back, I mean, sort of some very high-end restaurants say, basically, you can't make this at home.
Right.
I mean, that's in the fine print. Like,
well,
so I'm not suggesting that that's a bad
at all.
Well, I'm not suggesting that that's necessarily a bad cookbook or a bad thing or people aren't taking away something from it, but that isn't what this is.
I mean, a lot of times people buy chef's cookbooks just to see how a chef thinks or how a restaurant operates.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
But, you know, look, there's a long tradition, and you know, years ago, when Michael Batterbury was still alive, he had me like write something about this. There's a long tradition in Europe of chef's books that are written by chefs for chefs. Not so much here in the U.S. In the U.S., almost all cookbooks are published even by, like, hardcore restaurant chefs. Like, you're a hardcore restaurant chef. You know, like are published for non-pros. They have to appeal to non-pros. And what that means, typically, is things get dumbed down. And one of the first ones that, you know, that's kind of a pejorative way to put it, but, you know, it's like the chef doesn't really want to alter their recipes and doesn't really, like, know what it means to cook at home because they're a chef. And so, like, it's hard to get that balance. One of the first cookbooks that broke the American mold and actually was just like, I'm just going to give you the professional recipes, and if you don't want to soak all your anchovies in milk, then just don't make this recipe. It was French Laundry Cookbook way back in the day.
It still sells like crazy.
Yeah, right? Well, I mean, it was a great book. You know what I mean? I mean, whether or not you, like, are a fan of TK or you know, any of this stuff, is like, that is, like, they were like, I'm just going to tell you how this thing works.
Defining
yeah.
Book.
But I think this, like what you're trying to shoot for here is different. You're like, I want you to actually get this result without having to operate like I'm in the French Laundry, which is, or at Del Posto in your case. So it's like, I think it's a different and almost harder task.
Yeah, completely. I mean,
it took a long time.
We re-engineered all the recipes without dumbing them down.
And the reason for
doing it,
I mean, that the real question is why do the work for that, is that we felt like Mark's food comes, all the foundation of Mark's food comes from very, very traditional regional Italian cooking. And a lot of that cooking is sort of passed down through the homes and home chefs. I mean, our home cooks, let's say, and the families. So going back, so we're like, well, we should make this work in homes.
Yeah.
Like, this is Italian food that's sort of the foundation of this food is home cooking if you keep going back and back and looking at these regional recipes. So we got to make this work at home to carry on that tradition in some sense. So
right, plus also, it's just, you know, like if you go to Del Posto, which I encourage you to do, you know, everyone there is very, you know, keyed up on you having a positive experience. Like, the overwhelming sense you get is, like, a respect for the diner, mm-hmm, for the customer. And I think the same thing's flowing over to the book here, is, like, a respect for the person buying the book, that they're going to get the information that they need.
Absolutely.
And to me, really, that's the defining kind of service, and even in back of house, also characteristic of Del Posto. It's what makes Del Posto Del Posto.
Traditional hospitality. It's
yeah. Good. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, well, thanks so much
thank
for coming,
so much,
guys.
Thank you.
Cooking issues.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.